Welcome to the Udacity Thought Leader Series podcast. In today's episode, Udacity founder Sebastian Thrun sits down with Bing Gordon, general partner and chief product officer at Kleiner Perkins, former chief creative officer at Electronic Arts, to discuss how today's best thinkers apply key principles to make decisions and how education and gamification create a bond between the creator and user.
Hi, my name is Sebastian here at Udacity, our thought leadership series today with a person whom I admired for a long, long time, a good friend, a fellow bicyclist, Bing Gordon.
Thanks, Sebastian. It's great to be here, and I hope I learned something today.
Bing is actually one of the, maybe the godfather of our games, was one of the early members of Electronic Arts, became the marketing department for a while, and then became their creative director, did a lot with creative people, interesting enough. But then also moved to the other side and became a venture investor at Kleiner, one of the absolute premier venture firms here, started investing in games companies like Zynga. He sits on the board of Amazon, has helped Jeff Bezos to true greatness. Thanks for doing this, because I'm a big, just a big Zynga, but also a big Amazon fan. And now it's just a great friend of the company and here to talk to me.
As I told you, I've long been a fan of math that it can improve people's lives. And then zero marginal cost education and gamification as a structured way to create motivation and engagement.
Yes, so one very few people who puts the word gamification and education into one sentence. Where do you think we're going to be 50 years from now?
Well, when Electronic Arts, on our founding business plan, we quoted Marshall McLuhan, who said anyone who tries to distinguish between education and entertainment doesn't know the first thing about either. 50 years from now. You know, broadly speaking, we're in kind of a human potential crisis. What's so interesting about what you've been innovating on here for a while is trying to help people have motivation to increase competence and increase opportunity. So there is it 50 years from now, we both have seen multiple speakers from China talk. I think the end of empires is when the younger generation loses motivation. Mm-hmm. And so for America to still be the manifest destiny country, or for the West to be the manifest destiny culture, there needs to be regenerative motivation. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, success can be the enemy of success.
Well, that's interesting. So you really see a phase shift in the geopolitical powers that is underway today.
Well, it's really hard to for people who feel like they don't have to compete to be successful against people who feel they have to compete.
That's probably true.
And, you know, I'm certain you can see it in Udacity, for example, where the motivation comes from.
Yeah.
And I think in the early days of online learning, the notion, I think I remember something like the best scoring Stanford student in one of the early machine learning classes was like 50th.
No, 400th.
400th on a global basis. So
was the best Stanford student compared to our initial AI
and,
class students.
Yeah, and imagine if, and I'm pretty sure the best Stanford student didn't have a fake application. So, you know.
I hope not.
Motivation, we just find out in life, motivation trumps almost everything.
Yeah, that's so true. So let's talk about games, because you're basically the godfather of online games, of games in general. And you've seen the growth of EA, you've been on the boards of various game companies, you helped Zynga. Like, what makes a good game special? Like, what's the magic soap behind a good game?
There's, in all entertainment, there is magic when it really works. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even somebody like Steven Spielberg, he has ideas about what happens. He has a playbook, even has a time basis for every one of his scripts. Even he watches audiences in the first preview and gets surprised. So creators always get surprised. A guy named Neil Simon, a playwright, said he only opened plays that he thought were already perfect because he knows he's always surprised. So, you know, one of the things that is important in entertainment is is novelty and a surprise that keeps people on their toes. I have a scale I use, I call the wow scale. Mm-hmm. And you can put a camera on a customer and you can watch them give you four body languages. A four is a, Sebastian, you have to see this, this is so good.
Let's get and, to today.
And a three is a, it's kind of a Sheryl Sandberg lean in and smile. And a two is a knit and cross your arms and pull back. And a one is an abandon or a disconnect. And so a great game has a wow in the first session. It has 10 goods for every not good and has zero oh fucks.
Good.
So you can look for signs of reaction as the output, but the input, you know, I think all entertainers think that a sense of confirmation bias, stories give, stories and happy endings give audience and players a sense of satisfaction. In gaming, there's a notion of flow, mm-hmm. that the games I like tend to make me feel a little bit like solving a New York Times crossword puzzle. Mm-hmm. You know, you're focused, maybe like reading a book late at night.
Problem after problem after problem, get rewards, recognition, solve.
And then there's people play games like leveling up. And, you know, if you think about school as kind of a game, there's a level up from kindergarten all the way through grad school. Then, of course, you're done, and there's no more levels. And it's kind of a bummer when there's no structure.
So Pokemon at level 40.
Pokemon, yeah, that's hard to get to. So this notion of a structured life, like a sport with sidelines and referees and rules, but this constant improvement matters. And then in interactive, we saw this all the way back in the first spreadsheet, instant feedback is also pretty seductive. Mm-hmm. You know, in the university business, you remember as a professor how your SLA on response to student work was not as short as it could have been had you Udacity has bots instead. So you can see a bot can give instant feedback, a professor can't.
But even our graders give within 1 hour usually feedback.
That's good. That's good.
Because they get regraded by our customers. And if they don't do a great job, they leave us.
That's perfect. Again, you know, as we talked about before, you learned a long time ago the importance of calibration and feedback loops and fitness functions. Would that more parts of the world used it.
Yeah. So when you're sitting a client and someone pitches a gaming company to you as a startup, what do you look out for? What makes the decisions?
I think in any kind of investing, it always starts out with the founder and the founder team. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the top two things is, do you love the founder? Is she great? Does she have a vision? Can she bring you along as a customer? And in games, I usually pay attention to what did they used to do. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to be successful the first time around. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a couple companies lately. So somebody came out of Zynga, somebody came out of Electronic Arts, somebody came out of Curse, an esports company. Somebody else came out of Riot Games, that does League of Legends. And when they have that kind of learning experience, it's like looking at a technology that comes out of Facebook or Google, and you go, well, they can't be terrible. No. Or at least I can check really quickly if they're terrible. And then, the thing that is not interesting to me is when people show up and say, I'm building a platform.
Yeah.
Because, you know, platforms all get started as part of a single success. And civilian investors somehow or other get seduced and they think that platforms are less risky than doing single projects.
So you think build a vertical first, and if you figure out something here and make a success, build an adjacent one, make it a success. Right. And at some point, there might be some infrastructure, like Unity, where you have enough language in common.
Well, or like even like getting to Udacity, you start out trying to teach better.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, you start going, well, this can be repeated. And wouldn't it be great to talk to 50,000 students instead of 50 at a time? But it's a lot easier to get to serve the 50,000 if you've super served the 50.
Yeah.
And in games, it's pretty useful to know your customer is. I think there's three ages of gamers. Preteens who primarily want physical control, teenagers who are goofing around with their identity, and then adults who want self-improvement and escape.
Interesting. And that sounds very specific. What does it mean for a pre-teenager? You want these physical games to bumps into each other? Or?
Oh, yeah. They want muscles, they want wrestling, they want NFL.
Yeah.
You know, they're at a time where they say, they can't put it into words, but you know, I'm hoping to be a man. You know, I'm a little bit uncoordinated right now, and my mom tells me what to do, my teachers tell me what to do. So, you know, I want to take over here. So in The Sims, girls of that age, you know, wanted to be a god and run the household and make their parents do silly stuff, and the boys wanted to blow stuff up and fight each other. a game pitch usually has a couple key visuals.
Yeah.
I think before, it's great with a game design to do a Kickstarter campaign. In the old days, we used to do a mock package. And this is what the package is like. Do you want the game inside it? And now you can also do an Apple App Store or Steam detail page. So a founder who does that shows that they aren't just trying to please themselves, but they're thinking of customers.
Customer, right, exactly. Like, what's the experience going to look like? Let me shift gears. You are obviously massively responsible for my well-being through Amazon, which I use every day. And you've worked and built up Jeff Bezos and the company and helped as a director. Tell us about what it means to work with Jeff. Like, what makes him a good CEO? What is the experience with him? What can normal mortals like myself learn from him?
Well, I've told him that I think of him as the inventor of invention. And he does a couple things. And the first is, what he'd say, I asked him recently, how is he better as a CEO now than he was 15 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
So Brad Stone wrote a book about him and even talked about some of the contrarian things he did, but also some of the terrible things that happened in the early days of Amazon, as with many companies. And he said he's a better CEO now because he's learned to listen. He's a better listener. And you asked before, what about the famous Amazon six pagers? Well, the six pagers not only help clarify thinking of the presenter, but they're easier to listen to, because every proposal on Amazon gets put into a six pager, and so you know, even someone like me sees 50 of them a year.
Yeah.
And it's hard to hide bad ideas with prose. It's a lot easier to hide bad ideas with photos. Anybody knows an Instagram. And so that's the first thing, is a six pager makes listening easier. The second is, it's a real art form in discussions to keep everybody on the same tone of voice. Among the faculty members, everybody's trying to sound more learned than they actually are. People trying to sound more authoritative than they actually are. People, engineers especially, argue, they're yelling at each other and think they're having a content-based argument. And so Amazon is extraordinarily good at maintaining content-based discussions rather than tone of voice discussions. And then, you know, as I'm sure you've seen this, but my experience is the best thinkers start with first principles. And he is a first principle person. And then the other thing for the modern age is people who get the root causes and solve problems with systems rather than with short-term fixes. So first principles and systems-based thinking great foundations to build on. And in the first principles, he's come up with first principles of leadership, first principles of decision making, first principles of culture. And they're so good that the other people that he's built up the company with have latched on. He's got another thing for every plan called Tenants, mm-hmm. T-E-N-E-T-S, not renters. And every new idea has to describe, these are the Occam's razors on which we are going to make hard decisions. And it's a company that spends a lot of time talking about tenants. And every listing of the tenants says, these are the tenants unless you can think of a better one. And so just as he always talks about customer obsession, they also talk about unless you can think of a better idea. So this willingness to be open to improvements is rare among creative people. Most creative people I know don't want their ideas improved. They want to be, as you call it, demigods. And anyway, so I think it's kind of process and listening. And it's also a company that doesn't punish risk takers. Mm. And in Electronic Arts, it's very difficult to convince normal people that somebody who's just had a failed product might be more valuable.
Because of experience.
So now the question is, was that a good experience or a bad experience? And if you talk to the person and they don't know why it happened, there can be people who are less valuable after success. And it turns out they succeeded because they moved to the Silicon Valley at the right time, not because they did anything smarter. They succeeded because they were handsome, or they succeeded because they had parents who did something for them. And so it's always useful to, it's kind of a life skill to try to extract from people, are they going to be more successful next time based on what they learned from success or failure? So I came over today. I'm a fan. You remember we met before you went to Google way back when, and we were talking about the future of education and why you were such a good teacher. And so I wonder now, looking back, how has your in-person teaching changed the strategy at Udacity? There you can learn one student at a time, but you never exactly know what difference you made. You can see what their outcome is. And now you're trying to take what you learned kind of 50 or 100 or 200 students at a time and do it for tens of thousands.
I'd say, Bing, it's what you mentioned before about what's a successful game startup pitch, right? And what you pointed out is to say, look, if you think about yourself and how great you are, that's not going to be a great company. But if you think about your customer and how to connect with them, what their needs are and wishes are, you're going to be a great company. I'd say 98% of professors that I know never really think about the student in education. They go in, they're nervous, they have this deck of PowerPoints, they want to look funny, they want to impress. They often don't even understand if the students are left behind. Right. Like a classical one is you say something, right, and people nod. Now, students nod all the time, turns out. It's like there's a nerve thing in a certain age group that makes you nod. And when you ask them the question, does it make sense? Often half the students say no. And even the question, does it make sense from a professor's perspective, is a rare question. And somewhere deep inside, the professors kind of know it doesn't make sense. So they'd rather keep moving on. And you can cheat your way to an entire class without ever connecting with the student. And then, of course, there's a student questionnaire, right? Like, what do you think about professor? And most of my colleagues never read those, to be honest. They're mostly there to make the students feel good about themselves. They had some way of feedback into the professor. But once the class is over, you just go on vacation. So what have we learned? I think the key thing is true for any human relationship, which is if you as a human being can focus on the other side and understand the other side and add value, you're in a much better position than you focus on yourself. And that's a big deal for us. I mean, we work really hard. We have a fantastic staff that really goes the extra mile. We've made many mistakes. But our objective is always with the student. Whenever we sit down and ask, how can we resolve this? We don't ask, how can we save money? We ask, at the end of the day, the question, how can we set up the student for success? We have a singular metric, which is how many of our students or graduates find themselves in better jobs. That's our accountability. And then we fight to make this happen.
You know, there's in many business-to-business companies, there's a job function called customer success.
Right.
So there's sales, get the money out of people, and there's success, which is to keep them happy over a period of time. So you may be the first company in the history of education that focuses on customer success.
Yeah. So it's interesting, education, when you go to common universities, they all know where the ranking is, right? Stanford is up here, and Harvard and Yale. And then they produce a certain quality people. And by and large, let's say a Stanford graduate scores quite well compared, say, a local, minor college kind of graduate, not naming anybody here. But what they don't do is they don't ask the question, how much do we as an institution add?
Right.
Because
Freakonomics has data on that.
Do they?
Freakonomics says that Ivy League schools, or the selective schools in general, don't change the economic future of their students. The economic future of all their students is exactly what their SAT scores would predict.
Nice. So you should get admitted and not go.
Yeah, right. It turns out the people who don't go but get admitted have the same financial outcome as the people who go.
They save 4 years.
They save 4 years and, $400,000.
So now I would love to run this test among our Udacity students and see if we add any value. Let's find out. But it's true. We don't do admissions, I guess, so anybody can come to us and study.
Well, you've got in your data science, you got A/B testing. It's really hard to figure out what's an appropriate control. So Freakonomics is pretty good at coming up with slap your face stories with data.
Let me go back to you, my friend.
Okay.
Question.
Well, but one of the reasons I'm here is because I'm so curious about the whole thing that you're trying to accomplish, and bringing together this notion of teaching people at scale, but also creating a learning feedback loop.
Yes. So when we started out, I pitched my idea at Kleiner, which happened to make a really great choice in funding Coursera. We also pitched it at Andreessen Horowitz. And after Andreessen said, we're going to fund you, the check was in the bank, I said, hey, Mark, let's sit down and tell me what you really think about us. And he basically had a list of like a page and a half, tore everything apart, every aspect of what I coached presented. And in the end said, Sebastian, you're trying to be a platform. You should start with one vertical and do this really, really well.
Interesting.
Exactly your advice. So I basically scrapped my platform plans that existed up to this point. And started, okay, let's build a university. Let's find out this one vertical that works well. And then maybe at some point this vertical turns into a platform. And now we are somewhere in between.
Wildly interesting.
Yeah.
There's so many learning experiences like that don't get captured very well.
That's true. There's some good books. Let's see.
Ben's book's great.
Ben's book is great. The Hard Thing About Hard Things. He said they're hard.
It's, I think so very few business books are uncompressible. Mm-hmm. And, all Tom Friedman books can be compressed into their title.
Pretty much.
That's
interesting.
Malcolm Gladwell can usually be compressed into the first chapter. And Ben's book is uncompressible, which I think that's a mark of excellence. That's because if it's compressible, there's no advantage for finishing. So this whole notion of finishing. So if you have a course that can be compressible, finishing is kind of a fake metric. But Ben's book is uncompressible.
That's true.
You go, Ben. And I know he admitted that it was harder work than he ever expected.
That's cool.
I designed a class at USC. I helped start Games at USC. And mm-hmm. And within 5 years, it was picked as the best undergrad video game design program in the world.
Great.
And I did a syllabus on video game design, and it was pretty good. So if you want to, and by the way, there's some private universities teaching video game design that now get kind of half of their students into good game industry jobs, but there's there's still needs. So you got a design class, you could maybe have a video game design.
Well, what I love about this is, as much as I know about this is really project-driven, where students build something, as opposed to lecture-driven.
And Carnegie, the two good
that's
programs
the way it should
are Carnegie Mellon at USC. At Carnegie Mellon, the first semester you make five virtual worlds, and at USC, in the film school, the first semester you make five movies.
Nice.
And I love it when teachers become consultants, not not demigods. As consultants, is here's the problem. I'm going to try to give you just-in-time learning. I'm standing nearby. Good luck.
I mean, that's what we've learned here yesterday. When we give students lecture material, they're switched off.
Right.
And in the early days, our finishing rates were 2%, 3%, 4%. Not because the course was not compressible, but because it was dead boring. When we give our students projects to build something, we have a much higher success rate. And our mentors, our coaches, they really help students succeed.
And then, you know, the projects are so hard to create. It's really hard to keep testing and improving them.
That is very true.
So that's actually going to be part of your knowledge graph that can be increasingly valuable. And eventually, the same course can be personalized for each student.
Yep.
I would tell you, so I invented this at Stanford and USC, my teaching rubric, mm-hmm. or my grading rubric. And my grading rubric was you can't get an A from the professor.
You can only give it
from the professor, you can get a B+. No, to get an A, you got to get it from the real world. And at the time, 10,000 downloads of a game, that would be an A. Funding would be an A. Or a cover story in a magazine or by a blogger, that would be an A.
That's a great metric.
And, you know, it takes away, it depowers the professor if they can't give A's.
That's a great idea. Good. With that, I want to close because we're already 30 minutes in. I think it's a real pleasure having you here.
It's great to see
learning
you.
Learning from you.
Congrats on progress so far. Congrats to students.